Good evening to everyone here in Boston. This is the first time that I have been back in City Space as well in 18 months, so it's actually very great. It feels really good to be back with all of you here in the City Space event area. And I want to also say good morning, good afternoon, good evening to all of our online attendees, wherever you are in the world watching this event today, and particularly good afternoon for those of you who are in Seattle, because I would have to say that I still seek some silver linings to this pandemic, and one of them is that we have vastly expanded our definition and sense of community to be not only those we can see in person, but those who are part of our radio community and our online community. So we're very, very happy to be co-hosting tonight's event with KUOW in Seattle. So a round of applause for another great public radio station. As Amy said, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point, and this is Dori Scheimer. She's our senior editor and really the intelligence behind our whole Amazon series, because she did research for dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of hours, talked to many, many dozens of people, and single-handedly had to wrestle Amazon's very ample media relations department for what became an 8-hour on-air series and tonight's event as well, all about one of the most fascinating companies I have ever had a chance to cover and learn about. And we tried to learn all about it, but of course, we didn't learn all about Amazon because that is just not possible. It is too big. It is huge. It is its tentacles or its reaches everywhere in the United States and around the world. So one of the things I learned is that it's actually impossible, or at least very difficult, to really fathom all of the ways in which this one company is having an impact on our lives. And in a sense, that's exactly why we picked Amazon to do this really deep dive with, because it's emblematic, we think, of a tiny handful of tech companies that are so influential, I would argue they're reshaping society. And so with that in mind, with Amazon, we wanted to take a look at the good. And we heard a lot from a lot of people who had a lot to say about what they thought was good about Amazon. We wanted to take a look at the bad. And then we wanted to ask, like, how can we as a society who are living with this corporation or these corporations writ large maximize the good while minimizing the bad? And so that's why in tonight's sort of final conversation about Amazon, we want to round out the series with a discussion of our major takeaways about the company with that question in mind, how to maximize the good while minimizing the bad. Because really, as citizens in the society in which the tech companies are changing, that's answering that question is our responsibility. So what do we want to do as citizens once we understand the reach that that these companies have in our lives? So that's what we're going to try and explore a little bit tonight.
Yeah, and we tried in that first episode to answer this question, like, what is Amazon? It's a retailer, but it's so many other things in addition to that. So we asked listeners to participate and answer that question for us, playing a little Mad Libs. So here's some of the very many responses we got when we had people finish this phrase, Amazon is.
This is Melly Anamalai from Nashua in New Hampshire. Amazon is something I do my best to avoid using.
This is Betsy Carroll from Knox, Maine. Amazon is the prime example of all that is wrong with the world.
Hi, this is Wayne Simmons from Ellsworth, Maine. Amazon is the last resort. Thanks.
Hi, this is Andrea Learned in Seattle. Amazon is primed, pun intended, to step into global transportation emissions reduction leadership by prioritizing e-cargo bikes and cycle logistics for urban last-mile delivery. Thanks.
Aloha, this is Richard Schnecker from Wahiawa, Hawaii. Finishing a sentence of the day, Amazon is a monopoly.
Aloha.
Aloha to our listeners in Hawaii. So we want you to participate with that same phrase tonight. So using slido.com, hashtag on point, you can go there now and fill in the blank. Amazon is, And we will check out some of your responses later on tonight.
We want lots of audience participation from everyone here and everyone watching online. And by the way, I just noticed, apparently Dory and I have been working so closely on this project for the past many months that we started dressing very similarly. Mm-hmm. with blazers and dark jeans and brown shoes. But that is how the partnership works here. Okay, but by the way, at that same Slido hashtag on point, definitely over the course of the conversation, put in your questions wherever you are, because we'll be monitoring that and we want to incorporate your questions over the course of the conversation. Now, as I said, we talked to dozens of people in preparation for this series. Two of them in particular were just extraordinary and we want to have them as part of our conversation tonight. So they are Tim Bray and Joshua McNichols. And Tim is principal consultant at Textuality Services Now. He was a senior principal technologist and then vice president and distinguished engineer at Amazon Web Services, so AWS, from December 2014 to May of 2020. And he joins us now from Vancouver, Canada. So Tim, hello. This is the first time I've actually seen you. Welcome back. If he can hear us. Okay, we'll make sure he can hear us here in a second. So Tim, if and when you hear us, just wave your hand and I'll give you a proper hello. Our other guest tonight is Joshua McNichols. He's a reporter and host of the podcast Primed, which is all about Amazon. He works at KUOW and he's in Seattle. And Joshua, it is great to see you too. Can you hear me?
Hi there, happy to be here.
I do think we have a delay. Okay, we're going to try and figure that one out here. So first of all, with tonight, we wanted to loosely organize it into the three major takeaways that we learned about over the course of this series. And the first one we didn't actually get to.
Yes, I can hear you. There is a slight delay here
series,
for some reason.
Which is what does Seattle, the city of Seattle, have to teach us about Amazon's potential impact everywhere, Seattle being both the proving ground and home of Amazon's first headquarters. But I'm wondering if we can actually play a little bit of some of Joshua's reporting, because we talked to him about the fact that Seattle is oftentimes a place where Amazon might launch a new idea in a test phase, essentially. And one of the things they have done is they bought Whole Foods a while ago. And now they're trying to see if they need to move more forcefully into brick and mortar grocery stores. And Joshua did some excellent reporting on that. And he went to a new Amazon Fresh store in a Seattle neighborhood called Central District. And we want to listen to how that went. And he shopped with a native Seattleite named Victoria. So let's listen to a little bit of Victoria in the Amazon Fresh store.
Alexa, where do you find catfish?
I am not sure where to find catfish. Please check with a store associate for help.
Hey, Alexa, where do you find sweet potatoes?
I am not sure where to find sweet potatoes. Please check with a store associate for help.
Hey, Alexa, where do you find wine?
You can find wine at R5.
What does that tell you?
It tells me that she's not black. Hey, Alexa, where do I find black-eyed peas?
Find black-eyed peas at R1.
Okay. Well, maybe she's half black.
In talking to Joshua, he said that there's a real divide in Seattle between people like Victoria Beach, who are skeptical of Amazon's reach in her city. Her neighborhood is gentrifying, and this Amazon Fresh store is just the latest kind of physical example and representation of what she feels is kind of losing her neighborhood now to Amazon.
Right. And Joshua told you that what was interesting is Amazon goes in, and obviously you heard in that piece of tape that they stocked the store early on with things that weren't necessarily entirely what the neighborhood who had been shopping there wanted in their grocery store. So the company came in with a different perception than the actual customers it was supposed to serve, which is really odd because another one of our major takeaways is this is a famously customer-focused company. So
yeah, but what do we Joshua know? Also yeah. talked to, you know, several residents who this Amazon Fresh store is kind of in the retail space of this new high-rise apartment building. So while Amazon may have been catering to the people who lived in that specific building or in the buildings around it, they were blind to what this neighborhood had historically been and what, you know, the people who had lived there for decades were still trying to hold on to. And Amazon, you know, uses technology there. They have Alexas in grocery stores to tell you exactly where things are. But this isn't the only example where they missed the mark just a bit on the human component of applying that technology.
But then continued to adjust, though.
Right? Yeah. I mean, Joshua talked to a manager who said, yeah, we learned pretty quickly that there were some items that customers
were coming
in for. I can hear
you just a little bit now.
We changed the inventory and adjusted that pretty fast. Mm.
So the other thing that I found really interesting about this story that Joshua brought us is two things. One is Amazon is trying to really integrate technology into every part of its business, aka also every part of our lives. So there's a scene that Joshua had in his reporting where Victoria was trying to check out her items that she bought from this Amazon Fresh store. And you're supposed to just scan it, right? Or just... It's not even a scanner.
The cart detects the items that are in your cart, and that's how you check out.
Right. But it didn't detect anything in her cart. Yeah. So the employees were like, I guess you can just have it for free for today. But, you know, I guess they're okay with publicly debugging their high-tech grocery stores. But on the flip side of all this, there was a sense from some of the employees that Joshua talked to, and we will get him eventually, and he will tell you in much more detail than I can. But, Dory... share this part with us, where because they were working for Amazon, right? They weren't working for a business that only does groceries. Some of the employees actually felt that they had way more career paths or possible paths to growth than they would have otherwise, say, if they were working only for Whole Foods or only for a Stop and Shop or only for a Fred Meyer or something.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting piece of it because Amazon is... having to adjust to be more competitive in this labor market right now. Andy Jassy, the new CEO, seems to be really aware that the public perception of Amazon, an employer, needs to be improved. And Joshua's reporting reflects that they are making some strides in telling new employees at this Amazon Fresh store that there is career advancement to stay with Amazon, which is uniquely different than what we heard from warehouse workers mm-hmm. who said, yeah, they would train us, but they would tell us to take that training and go elsewhere, that there wasn't that room for advancement within Amazon.
Right, that in fact it's a completely different company.
Yes.
If you're away from the corporate side, and I would say that the Amazon Fresh stores are still fairly close to the corporate side because it's not a fully established mm-hmm. business that they've let out into the world. If you're away from the corporate side, it's a completely different company. That's what we heard a lot from current and past employees.
Yeah, including Tim Bray. I mean, who described it as, you know, the best job he ever had and an amazing place to work, which was different than warehouse employees.
Well, what I'd like to do is play a little bit more, if possible, from some of the reporting that Joshua gave us, because not only is that Amazon Fresh store an example of how Seattle has had to absorb Amazon as its biggest business because of the headquarters being there. But of course, there's the ancillary impact, both negative and positive. And he has actually done reporting on how some people in Seattle think that it's quite good to have Amazon as the biggest presence in the city. For example, with some businesses that surround Amazon's main campus in Seattle. And here's what one business person told Joshua.
I know Amazon can be a controversial topic for folks. Our experience with them as a landlord, you know, as a tenant of theirs, has been really positive.
So do you remember why he told Joshua that it was a positive experience?
Yeah, so that was Jeremy Price. He owns Wilmot's Ghost. It's an Italian restaurant and the base of Amazon's fears. So Amazon has done a lot through the pandemic as a landlord. They own the property around their campus, and there's a lot of businesses and restaurants. And they use that to attract talent to work at Amazon headquarters. So they have not asked for rent from those businesses around their campus in a year and a half. because they see that as an investment in keeping their workforce, that they didn't want, when they returned to the office, when they had people come back in the office, to see this deserted neighborhood, that they wanted it to still be vibrant for their workers. So it was in their best interest to, you know, swallow that lost rent for a year and a half to maintain this kind of cultural neighborhood that they had allowed to sprout.
Right. Now, I just want to acknowledge,
looks like I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Here and everyone watching online.
No.
Let us admit the truth. It's super bizarre for two people sitting in Boston to talk about what's happening in Seattle. And it's incredibly complicated, the story of Amazon in Seattle. So we're working on the fly here. For those of you who are watching, especially from Seattle, if you have access to Twitter, because our Slido's on pause here for a second while we deal with the technical challenges of getting Josh and Tim back on, and I want to let the team do that. But hop on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is MegnaWBUR, which is MegnaWBUR. And shoot me a tweet if you're watching this from Seattle, and let us know, like, what you think the reality of having Amazon headquarters in Seattle is, because when we get Josh back, I will we'll ask him about things about jobs, about housing, about gentrification, about the cost of living, about what it's like politically to have a $1 trillion corporation owning your backyard, for lack of a better phrase. But Joy, I'll let you just pick up here with some of the other things we learned about Amazon in Seattle while I get on my Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to that kind of split among residents in Seattle, there's, of course, people. Amazon is an enormous employer that attracts talent to Seattle. That has increased. If you were fortunate enough to be a property owner before Amazon moved in, you have benefited immensely from those rising property costs. Of course, that has created an affordable housing crisis for those who haven't. But that kind of illustrates that split that people feel.
Yeah. And I mean, here in the Boston area, we came close to potentially experiencing that, because you'll all remember Amazon's sort of Hunger Games death match for HQ2, as they called it. And Boston actually put forth an interesting proposal, because we here in Boston were attracted by the potential. Amazon was saying they were going to bring 50,000
jobs. Yes, can you hear me?
But where are you going to put all these new people? Like, what part of the city were we going to develop here? Did we want to inherit some of the challenges that Seattle did? But of course, everyone here remembers how that went, right? Ultimately, it went to Virginia and New York. Oh, no, first New York, then Virginia, because New York said no.
Yeah.
Right. So
rescinded.
But in a sense, a lot of people also thought that Virginia was kind of was going to get it anyway, because Amazon wants to be close to
Washington
D.C. Okay.
Meghna, so, I think I'm here. I don't know if you can hear me now.
Is that you, Josh?
It's me.
Oh, that is fantastic. Wonderful. Hopefully we'll get my like bizarre face off the screen.
This is how we look at each other
every day. Actually, that's true. That's literally how Dory and I stare at each other. But Josh, can you still hear me?
I can still hear you.
Okay. And Tim, can you hear me also? Okay, we're going to get Tim. Well, this is great. I mean, we're radio people, so just having Josh's voice for me is okay. But I'm sorry for everyone watching that you can't actually see him. But we have been trying to sound smart, Josh, about how Amazon is having an impact on the city of Seattle. So set us straight here. I mean, that's a huge question. Where would you begin to answer that question, Josh?
Well, you know, like many places, there's delivery vans everywhere. There's warehouses all over the place. But here we also have experimental grocery stores that kind of come in many different flavors, and pop-up stores, the Amazon 4-star store, and all kinds of different things where Amazon works out some of its new technologies. And then we've got the corporate headquarters that employs so many people that, like, if you go to a soccer game, one of my bosses told me the story about his soccer team, like, any group of parents that you're talking with, there's going to be one person there who works for Amazon, or who has a sibling who works for Amazon or something. So, I feel like Amazon, one of the local columnists here described Amazon's effect on Seattle as that of a prosperity bomb, you know? Yeah. And on the one hand, like, that's great. It's a lot of money. But the money isn't necessarily shared equally. There's a sort of, you can imagine if you just drop a big bag of money on a crowd of people, it's not necessarily going to bring out the best of humanity. And so, you know, we've got, because we have a shortage of housing, you know, there's really high competition for land, and not everybody can afford to live here. Teachers and firefighters can't afford to live here, and have to move out of the city, have to live south of the city. And so there's a sort of, even though we have this problem in many American cities right now, where there's sort of two different classes, in Seattle, it's really strong because Amazon is a big fish in this pond. And those problems associated with a tech sector having the wealth in this economy and a non-tech sector maybe lacking access in the same way, it's really strongly felt here.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's great. We can see you now. And it's just great to see you, Josh.
And good to see you.
Everyone, I mean, I just want to give our City Space folks a hand because this is on the fly debugging, which is always a very a heart rate inducing task. But also, Seattle is coming through on Twitter. I love you guys because, Josh, while we were waiting to get you back up, I just opened up my Twitter to folks in Seattle and said, like, how do they think Amazon has been transforming Seattle? And we have Irish Love saying Amazon is ready to walk out of Seattle and is going to the east side of Seattle due to taxes and politics. Mark says Amazon has been turning Seattle into a transient corporate village, using the city's infrastructure and resources, but not paying back. Can you talk about that a little, Josh?
Yeah. I mean, Amazon's kind of famous here for fighting against corporate taxation. And so, you know, they like to talk about the jobs and the wealth that they bring here. And they've been trying to soften their image in recent years by, you know, giving by charitable gifts to fight, you know, climate change or to reduce homelessness or build housing. And those have been significant. But, you know, that came after many years of criticism for not doing enough to mitigate their bad effects. You know, they don't like to come out swinging publicly against corporate taxation, but they, you know, they fund the organizations that do. So there's a sense that, you know, many people sort of have this idea that Amazon thinks highly of itself, but doesn't necessarily want to pay for the things that help distribute the wealth around or reduce some of the problems that come with that wealth.
Did you have a question for Joshua about anything that he talked to you about?
Yeah, Joshua, we talked about Victoria Beach, and we just played that one clip of her, but you talked to her for much longer. And I just would love for you to shed some more light on how Victoria feels about this kind of new physical Amazon presence in her neighborhood.
Well, the thing that really interested me in talking to her is that, you know, we're here in Seattle, we're very familiar with the effects of Amazon's growth in a neighborhood we call the South Lake Union neighborhood, which used to have a lot of warehouses, had some affordable housing, but, you know, that's kind of where Amazon's explosive growth was centered for a long time. But as, you know, the grocery store expansion is sort of a new way in which we can try to measure how people perceive Amazon in different neighborhoods that it's sort of colonizing in a way. That's probably the wrong word to use. That's not really fair. But and so this neighborhood is a neighborhood where for years there's been a lot of, you know, historically this was a mostly Black neighborhood. And as the city has gotten more expensive, you know, some residents have cashed out and made a good deal. But others have, you know, been forced out as rents have increased. And you know, many of those Black neighborhoods have moved away. Victoria Beach describes herself as the last Black household on her block. So when Amazon, which kind of blew up in the South Lake Union neighborhood, comes in with a presence in this neighborhood, I was curious how it would be perceived and whether the company's efforts to be seen more as a benefit would be something that was embraced by residents who had historically been feeling pressured and pushed out here. And I think Victoria, maybe even in ways that you didn't see in that clip, walks that line. Because not only was Victoria sort of looking for foods that she was comfortable with in the store, she also applied for a job at that Amazon Fresh. She's 62 years old, but she thought, you know, I could work here and maybe this would be a good opportunity for me. I need a little bit of extra cash. But she decided not to. She pulled out after applying for the job and getting it because of what her friends would think. And what she said is that she was afraid she would be perceived as a traitor. And I think it's because of some of those complexities where, you know, it's kind of, I think if you're in any conversation you're a part of in Seattle about Amazon, you have to be able to be empathetic also to so many people that we know have not won the prosperity game that Amazon presents, you know? And you can't just parrot the talking points about innovation and bias for action and things like that and seem like you're getting the full picture. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of the full picture now, is that Tim Bray that we can actually see and hopefully hear?
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you, Tim. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. Just a slight delay there. Yeah. That's a manageable delay. It's good to see you, Tim. Thank you for bearing with us as we had to debug all of that, but it's great to have you. That's Tim Bray again. He used to be a senior executive at Amazon Web Services, and I have a lot to talk with you in a couple of minutes, Tim, about whether or not Amazon is a monopoly. So hang on here for just a second. But we did do that poll. Can we show the results of the first poll about what everyone watching thinks Amazon is? So everything from essential to my personal life to unraveling the fabric of our communities. Union busting, also good and bad. So before we move on, Dory, this is something that we saw over and over and over again in all 8 episodes about the complexity of people's feelings about this company.
Yeah, and we had a listener in our last episode who kind of verbalized this in such a strong way that she has relied on Amazon more than ever in the pandemic to get her the basic things that she needed. And feels so guilty every time she clicks buy. And we heard that over and over again, whether people used Amazon or not, feeling these complex feelings about a company that is just so present in our lives. This feeling that it's unavoidable, but I want to avoid it. To people just saying, this has made my life easier. Mm-hmm. And I think Amazon is recognizing that kind of chasm more than ever.
Yeah. And so the reason why I found this personally really fascinating is that, you know, feelings might be feelings, but again, regarding that question of like, what do we as citizens want to do about these giant corporations, actually how we feel about their impacts on our lives is a very big driver to when it comes to deciding about policies we'd either support or not support. So we're going to get to that in the third part of tonight's conversation, but we have another poll.
Yeah, we have another question for you. So before we get to this next part of tonight's conversation, we want to know about your Amazon habits. So for our audience tonight, we want you to go back to Slido.com, #onpoint, and tell us how often you think you use Amazon. And there's a couple choices for you, and we'll get back to see how often they do. In a few minutes.
Yeah. How often do you think you use Amazon? It's our next question for all of you here and online. And again, Slido.com on point, #onpoint is where you can send your questions to, and they are coming in. So we'll get some of these incorporated here in just a second. But so we talked a little bit about Seattle with some bumps in the road there. But our next big takeaway was how strong Amazon's corporate culture is. Like I describe it as like superhero strong, but maybe not in like the superhero positive save the world kind of way. Because even its massive PR department, through and through, every way they interacted with you, Dory, mostly reflected this corporate culture. And so the reason why I think citizens need to understand that is that once you do and you get a better handle about what the corporate culture is, you will understand that everything Amazon says publicly and does, everything you read from them is filtered through that culture. So it's really important to understand it. And Dory interacted with Amazon PR for like, what, 6 straight months?
6 months.
But we successfully got several of the company's vice presidents to join us. And I wanted Dory to pull back the curtain a little bit about what that was like standing there before the Goliath that is Amazon's media relations department.
Yeah, I think often when we are doing a show and we have a question for a corporation, for a member of Congress, we reach out with that question. And often they send us an email back and say, here's the answer, or no, we don't want to give you an answer. And we go from there. But with Amazon PR, no matter what the scope of the question was, I would get on conference calls, and often I would get on these calls to ask them my question, and there would be a dozen people from their PR team on that call. And I think, well, first of all, I sweat through those calls in full transparency, but they are so disciplined, and they are very siloed. They have what's called pizza teams. So as Amazon grew, they wanted to maintain this culture that every team was small enough to share a pizza to solve a problem. And they really have maintained that. And through their PR, it's the same way. So when we talked to AWS, that those people were completely separate from the people we talked to about Amazon's relationship with small sellers in the marketplace. But the consistency of the language in which they talked to me was remarkable.
The consistency, the discipline, the narrowness of focus with these teams, it was absolutely incredible. And just to give you a sense of how different that is from other companies and organizations that we have to reach out through their media relations department, it's night and day. Like sometimes, as Dory said, like we might get an email back and then there's a little back and forth and the person comes on the show, and then we might get like a really long email of all the things they claim that we said wrong, which usually we do not. But like it's all post-play. But Amazon was very, very active even before they would agree to have someone on. And Tim, if you can hear me, first of all, I'm just really delighted to see you. But as the man that's worked in Amazon at a senior level, when you were there, I mean, how would you describe what the, this is another big question, but how would you describe what the company's, the corporate culture was like?
Well, it's the best job I ever had. And that was partly because of the culture. It's the best managed place I ever worked, including the places where I was the CEO. And part of that is due to the application of the Amazon leadership principles, which sound kind of lame and like platitudes, but actually turned out to work reasonably well in practice. And one of the places where they're most intensely applied is in hiring and promotion. So there's a conscious, explicit effort to hire and promote, you know, people who exhibit what are considered to be the desirable parts of Amazon culture. And, you know, one of the core attributes they like there is attention to detail, you know, understanding the problem you're trying to solve in great detail and not getting away with arm waving and statement of platitudes, but getting down to the very precise facts of the matter. So I suspect that may work better in running a cloud computing division than it does in running a PR division, based on your experience. But yeah, the culture is a very real thing, and it really works.
But that's the corporate culture for corporate employees, right? Does that same culture apply to the thousands of people who work at Amazon away from Seattle headquarters? In, you know, I mean the fulfillment center workers, for example, are the primary example, right?
Yeah. I've never been in one of those, so I'm not authoritative. But given, you know, the rate at which they hire and the rate of attrition and turnover, it's hard to believe that you can, you know, consciously build that kind of conscious culture engineering, because it's a very time-consuming process. And, you know, when the average tenure of somebody is measured in months, you know, is that going to actually happen?
Joshua, I'm wondering, I'm just taking your question, Dory. I'm just going to steal
it. Go for it.
In terms of dealing with Amazon media relations, have you had similar experiences as what we were describing?
Yeah, totally. I mean, Amazonians constantly pepper their speech with references to innovation, for example, or they'll slip in the phrase day one. This is kind of a dog whistle that tells people that you don't take anything for granted, but you treat every day like it's the first day of Amazon's existence when it was still scrappy. Almost all of Amazon's leaders do this multiple times in the same interview, but I've also noticed that ambitious lower level employees do it too, like even grocery store employees. There's also some trickle down with how people at Amazon talk about unions. You know, Amazon fights unions. Its leaders like to emphasize, you know, not the fight against unions, but rather how the company rewards innovations and results. And I hear that kind of talk a lot at the top of Amazon. But when Amazon connected me with grocery store employees, I also heard this there, that unions hold people back, imposing rules about seniority and stuff that stifle innovation.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, Joshua, I'm sure you've heard the phrase delight the customer a few times in talking to Amazon, Amazonians.
Yeah.
And what I thought was so interesting about the questions that we were asking is oftentimes we were asking Amazon to define who the customer was. I mean, when we were talking about AWS, when we were talking about Marketplace, for instance, you know, are you trying to delight the customer? Is that the seller on Marketplace or is that the consumer? So you see these kinds of dodging, honestly, when you have to get down to those kinds of specifics oftentimes.
We also had a very strange experience, which I don't think I've ever actually had, where we spoke with a senior executive at Amazon. And again, this goes to the discipline of the company, that we didn't give them our questions in advance. We would never do that. Right. But when I was talking with him, there would be this like tiny delay and we would hear pages being flipped. And it wasn't him flipping the pages. It was definitely a media relations person there, like flipping the pages for him to find the right answer for him to basically read off the page. Now, everybody has talking points, right, when they speak to the media. That's not unusual. But having it all written out in a notebook and you can hear the pages turning was a first for us. What really opened my eyes about it is that this particular senior executive was a very dynamic man. Mm-hmm. He had lived an amazing life. And once they like let him off the leash, so to speak, he had very interesting things to say about the company. But this is not a company that's going to take that risk to begin with. But I should say that you heard Tim say this was the best job you've ever had. And yet you left this job. Why?
Well, that's a matter of public record. You can just type Tim Bray Amazon into Google and you'll get all the gory details. I left Amazon because during the early days of COVID, there was a big dispute about whether Amazon was taking good enough care of the warehouse workers. And there were two sides to the dispute because, you know, Amazon was putting a lot of work into it, but, you know, the warehouse workers were still acting scared and protesting. And then there were some white collar office workers who were organizing activism on, you know, to expose the concerns of the warehouse workers. And Amazon reacted to this by firing all of them. And I couldn't really be comfortable with that, so I left. But that's a long time ago. That's old news. What you're talking about is much more interesting.
It may not be old news to everyone, Tim, but could you just walk us a little bit more through that decision? Why was it that particular thing that you were in a high-level job at AWS, which is a hugely important part of the company, but you let it all go because of treatment of employees? Well, what was it about that that made you make that decision?
Oh, well, I was carrying a VP rank, and I think that, you know, in the world of business, once you've gotten to a VP rank, you really have to be part of the leadership team, and it's just not okay to step out and go rogue and start, you know, engaging in external company-facing activism. And so I was, you know, I was very unhappy with what the company had done in that situation. And since I didn't feel free to speak up about it, I thought my only alternative was to leave, so I left.
But do you think, though, that was also reflective, not your decision, but how Amazon handled that was also reflective of its corporate culture, about it does not, you know, they have that famous leadership principle of disagree but commit, but those who disagree, do they suffer sanction at Amazon?
No, in general, they don't. It is absolutely okay to have a vigorous, lively internal debate. But, you know, one of the reasons I left was that I kind of liked many aspects of the Amazon culture. And I really disliked that decision. It seemed to me egregiously stupid. Have these people never heard of the Streisand effect? You know, it seems like they were painting letters of fire 500 feet high in the sky saying, we don't want you to look at this. And not only was it you know, I felt fairly brutal and amoral. It was also stupid. So I think that represents actually a major failure of Amazon culture, and just not something I could live with peacefully.
So another takeaway regarding the strength of Amazon culture that I think it's important for people to understand is that in one of our episodes, we talked about the fact that Amazon is also becoming kind of a little factory for future executives, right? So lots of people absorb Amazon's corporate culture and then go off to managerial and executive positions in other companies. And we heard quite a bit about that.
Yeah, we did. I think that's one of the key why it matters questions when we look at Amazon, the employer. They are raising the next generation of corporate leadership, and we're already seeing that happen. We had a former Amazon executive who talked about, you know, his kind of club of people he came up with at Amazon who are now leading many major companies we're all familiar with. So the Amazon style of management, while they say, we just want to take the best stuff with us, it is really influential in the broader labor market and for corporations across the country.
And in this case, we've been talking a lot about corporate culture and not talking at all about actual business practice, right? Which is a different and huge thing too, which, you know, success does breed imitators. So how Amazon does business, you may see in other businesses, perhaps closer to your actual direct life. But again, listen to our series and you'll hear a lot about that. But George, do you want to see what our poll revealed?
Yeah, and I want to say, I just saw in Slido someone ask why we didn't have a zero option, which is pure human error on my part. So that is why. So I appreciate all of you who don't use Amazon at all. And that's the really uncomplicated answer to that. But let's see what the poll results for those of you who do use Amazon, how often you're doing so. In the meantime, we got this question about what happens if all the Bed Bath & Beyond stores close. So, you know, an alternative, a brick and mortar alternative for many of the items that people use for Amazon. And I think when in our last episode talking to Brad Stone, we are seeing consumer habits changing. While there was a lot of dependence on e-commerce in the pandemic, now people do want to be able to go to the store. So that's kind of an open question, I think, of what will happen with brick and mortar in that kind of format.
Absolutely. Okay, so here are our results. How often do you think? Now, see, this is why we put an asterisk around think. Use Amazon 1 to 5 times a week, that vast majority of respondents. Okay. So Josh, actually, let me ask you, how many times do you think you use Amazon per week?
Oh, I use it so often. You know, it's like we explored this a little bit in Primed, how, like, you know, as companies merge, you know, there becomes less incentive to support the little place where you would buy this or that. There are more and more things that are just, you know, we used to have this regional department store called Fred Meyer. It's now part of, you know, the Kroger empire. I don't see a huge sort of local benefit to buying my, you know, my socks through Fred Meyer anymore. You know, I just get them through Amazon now. But it's, you know, the world of grocery stores is still very hyper-local in a lot of places. We've got local grocery stores, that we can support, and so the world has not totally changed there yet. There are a lot of things where you can still support mom and pop shops. But, you know, it's been interesting to see how main streets have continued to evolve through even the pandemic in ways that seek to distinguish what they can do from what Amazon can do. You know, even where there is no Amazon present on some of these little neighborhood business districts, you can see the effect of Amazon in how these little shops are selling the experience of coming in and, you know, posting something on their Instagram wall that proves that you were there, you know?
Well, Tim Bray, can I ask you, what do you think is the most accurate answer to this poll question that we asked about how many times people use Amazon per week?
I think the interesting thing is I bet that number is coming down. I think that Amazon has gotten such a a bad buzz that there are a few people out there who absolutely do not, you know, consciously are trying to avoid it. So I think that is coming down. I've been doing a little bit of that myself, and I've discovered that for a whole lot of things, you know, there's lots of other good places to buy stuff online. People have been watching Amazon's success and trying to emulate it with some degree of success. When I'm buying an electronics commodity like a TV or a Bluetooth adapter, a Thunderbolt adapter or something like that, I don't want to go and look at it. I just want to go online and get it. I recently bought a TV and I got it from Costco instead. I bought some jeans and I went and got them from Levi's directly. So I think that's becoming an increasingly viable thing to do and something we're going to see more and more of.
Okay, so this is blowing my mind. I want to be perfectly honest because I personally think the answer is more than 15 times per week for almost everybody. Because we didn't say how many times a week do you use Amazon Marketplace, right? We said how many times a week do you think you use Amazon, right? And so if you watch Netflix, you are using Amazon.
I don't know if anybody Zooms in here, also on AWS.
Also on AWS. And if you even from some of the local stores that you're buying online from, it may be getting fulfilled by Amazon. So this was another huge takeaway from me that like it makes total sense that we think first and foremost of Amazon as the retailer, right? Because it is the world's largest retailer. But its presence in our lives, its even bigger presence in our lives, is largely invisible. Like if AWS wasn't there, it's not the only, obviously, I'm talking about Tim Bray's former job, but it's not the only player in the cloud computing services, but it's a huge one. And we don't even think about it every day. So Tim, can you just, focusing on AWS for another minute here, how influential or important do you think AWS is to Amazon as a company and how much presence it actually does have in people's lives?
Well, it has a huge presence in people's lives. The world of IT, information technology, as we say, is huge, $3 or $4 trillion a year. And all the cloud companies together are only maybe 100 billion or 200 billion. So it's not as though they're dominating the whole space. Having said that, basically all the startups, the internet companies that came along in the last 10 or 20 years are on the cloud. They don't build their own data centers. They just don't anymore. Netflix was an example, but lots of others, your Pinterests and your Intuits and your, and so on and so forth. So those are the kinds of things people tend to interact with most often. And in a very high proportion of those cases, probably way over 50%, you're going to one cloud or another. And AWS is the biggest of the clouds. So, you're going to AWS more times than anybody else. So yeah, rephrasing the question that way, I would think it highly probable that there are very few hours in the day when anybody who's using a computer isn't interacting at some level with AWS.
That is the answer I was hoping for. There are very few hours in the day that we may not be interacting with Amazon. And in full disclosure, I'm pretty sure, don't actually quote me on this, but I'm 90% sure that even WBUR's website is hosted on AWS. But anyway, so this was...
If you want to find out, there's a little website called isitonaws.com. Go check it out. Type in any old, or paste in any old URL and it'll tell you.
You built that website, right, Tim? Is it on AWS? Did you build that website?
Yes.
Okay. Do we want to do our? Is it? It's time for our third. Our third poll.
Yeah,
okay.
Let's do it. So we have one last poll question for all of you. Thank you for participating on Slido.com #onpoint, and tell us what you think should happen to OnPoint, to Amazon. We're not asking that. A couple options for you. If you think Amazon is too big, should it be broken up? Should regulators change antitrust rules to rein Amazon in? Should we do nothing about Amazon and its size and scope in our lives? Or if you have another opinion, feel free to choose other. And you can also send us in Slido what you think that other option should be.
Oh, so many good questions coming in. Okay, I promise everyone we're going to get to some of these. But before we get to why we're polling about what we should do, we being society, about Amazon, there was a really great question here. What did you hear about work stress among headquarters white-collar staff at Amazon headquarters. I've heard about staff crying on the job and having to respond to 150 calls or alerts per week.
Yes, I think that I learned in talking to a lot of Amazon employees through producing this series that there's very split opinions. My takeaway is that there's a very particular kind of person who succeeds at Amazon, that its management style really works for some people, that they thrive on that kind of structure and commitment to those leadership principles. And there's clear kind of definitions of what you need to do to be successful as an Amazon employee. And to others, that kind of expectation and rigidity is extraordinarily stressful. And I talked to several Amazon corporate employees who said, you know, I did 3 or 4 years and I've never been so miserable and I had to get out. And it was, I mean, we had one voicemail who said it was ruining her life to work for Amazon. So I think I think there is a certain kind of person who thrives, but that it can be a very intense culture.
So a couple more questions from people in the audience and watching online. Josh, I'm going to turn this one to you because you've also had to deal with Amazon media relations a lot. There have been, over the past couple, many years, more and more focus on how Amazon treats its employees, right? So is their marketing and PR campaign working to improve their image? And being in Seattle, how would you respond to that question?
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that they reflect on the old leadership principles, now they reflect just as often on the newest ones, which prioritize employees, making Amazon one of the best places to work. So, I mean, they're talking about it a lot. We've had several big exposés in the New York Times or in the local paper that have really stuck in their craw and made them really uncomfortable. And they don't feel like that press is accurate. They talk about how they feel it's inaccurate, but these stories keep coming up every few years or so. And I think they're really tired of that. And I think they've figured out that they're going to have to do something about it. But it's so recent that these were added to the leadership principles, and many of their corporate employees are still remote. So I'm going to be really curious what happens when they come back to the office. This is going to be the moment when a lot of people decide whether or not to leave Amazon and go work for Facebook or go work for Microsoft, you know, which is sometimes kind of a retirement community for Amazonians. You know, they go back and forth, so that's not totally fair. But, you know, and that's one reason why Amazon is working so hard to keep the businesses around its corporate headquarters open, is it wants that place to be seen as lively and exciting, and there's a reason for you to come back here. So,
but just to underscore the point you made, Josh, those new leadership principles were only added this summer, right? In the tiny, like, half second interregnum between Jeff Bezos and Andy Jassy, right? But one more question from the audience here. And by the way, everyone who's here with us at City Space and everyone watching online, because we had a little bit of that rocky start, I hope it's okay if we go over by a couple of minutes, because we really do want to talk about this monopoly question too. So thank you for bearing with us, but we're getting to the meat of things here. But Tim, before we get to the monopoly question, we've got someone here who wants to know about a little bit more about AWS. Is there a risk that Amazon Web Services could censor internet websites and content in the future?
Well, there was quite a bit of controversy when AWS kicked Parler off just before the election, I think that was. Or no, that was around the January 6th incident, I think it was. And any operation these days that is, you know, hosting other people's discourse and messaging has to worry about, you know, the very severe conflict that exists out there between everybody's desire for speech to be free and then the fact that some speech turns out to be very highly dangerous and lead to, you know, massive amounts of illegal behavior. I wouldn't want to be the one making those calls. And I think that, you know, in terms of what we're doing on the internet, we're still learning. We still haven't learned really how to have a discourse that remains reasonably open and keeps what we call the trolls somewhat under control. So sure, it's absolutely the case that AWS might and in fact has, you know, shut down voices that are just ejected from AWS, voices that they didn't want to host. But I wouldn't think it's worse there than it might be, at Facebook or Google or Reddit or really anywhere else. It's a problem that the whole industry is grappling with.
Right. And so that's why this final question, I feel like, is so vitally important about the power, right, that these companies have. You saw the poll briefly about how I think most people who answered said that we should probably break it up. Is that what the dominant response was in the polls?
Or regulation.
Regulation. Okay, regulation. Thank you for that. She fact-checks me as well. But so our third and final takeaway for tonight is really this question of how do we come down on understanding whether or not Amazon is a monopoly, right? Or do we even have an accurate definition of what a monopoly is in the 21st century economy? And let me just quote Brad Stone, who's with Bloomberg, who's written a couple of really great books about Amazon and what he told us in episode 8 of our series. He said, basically, Amazon sits on a pile of cash. It has the ability to attract the best of the best talent in technology and engineering. And those two things in combination allow them the freedom to invade industries. And then I had told him that the way the accrual of those advantages work, it gives them exponential power over most other companies. And those exponents just add on top of each other. And then Brad agreed, and he said, that's why regulators are moving with panic to slow down Amazon's growth. And Andy Jassy, the new CEO, is also trying to usher in an era that recognizes criticism of the company, underscoring that with success comes responsibility. But the energy, the political energy, I guess, around Amazon's power, Brad said, is undeniable. So, Tim, here's my question for you. Before we get you to answer whether or not Amazon is a monopoly, you actually did answer the question in the form of a 6-page narrative. So can you just briefly tell us what is the 6-page narrative in Amazon? What is that thing?
So in Amazon, when a major decision is to be made, obviously there's going to be a meeting. And what makes Amazon unique is no PowerPoints are allowed. For anything that really matters, somebody has to write a narrative. There can be 1 pages, 2 pages, but 6 pages are the most common. And normally they take the form of a PR/FAQ, which stands for Press Release Frequently Asked Questions. And in that document, whoever is proposing whatever they want to have done has to write a press release for what's going to be said when you launch whatever you want to launch, and then a bunch of questions about it. And it imposes a very heavy burden on the author of that document to write a compelling linear story that anybody can understand. And I think it is a much better way to make decisions. And it's one of the reasons why Amazon has been successful.
And so you wrote a 6-page narrative about whether Amazon is monopoly and should it be broken up, which I love that. Use their own technique to analyze the company. And how, after writing the 6-page narrative, what did you conclude?
Well, my goal was specifically that AWS should be spun out of Amazon. And I don't think we have time to dive deeply into that, but I believe strongly that AWS should be spun out of Amazon. But to answer your larger question, Amazon and its big tech peers, and in fact, the whole top tier of the U.S. economy is rife with monopoly. Beer is monopolized. Mattresses are monopolized. Eyeglasses are monopolized. Cheerleading squads are monopolized. Web search is monopolized. Desktop office software is monopolized. Large-scale marketing services for things imported from China are monopolized. It would really be very, very good for the health of the United States and the economy of the Western world if the anti-monopoly agencies in the U.S. government went in there aggressively and broke up, not just Amazon, yes, Amazon, but also Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, who am I forgetting? Anyhow, Google, and actually bring a modicum of balance of power and real good old-fashioned competition back to the U.S. economy, because at the moment it is sorely lacking. Now, big tech is a place that it sticks out in particular vividness, and Amazon sticks out even in that coterie. But, let's not kid ourselves that we have an Amazon problem. What we have is an overly high concentration of wealth and power in the economy that urgently needs to be fixed. And the best first steps forward is some serious corporate breakups.
So you're bringing the fire now, Tim Bray. I love it. But so we talked to David Boies, the famed litigator. He's argued in front of the Supreme Court a lot on a variety of cases. And we talked to him because in the late 90s and early 2000s, he was seconded by the Justice Department to try a monopoly case against another Seattle-based, well, Redmond-based company specifically. See, I know my Pacific Northwest geography, guys. The Microsoft monopoly case that the Justice Department brought in the late 90s. And Tim, especially, I want you to listen to this, because here's one of the things that David Boies told us about whether or not the federal government should be looking at Amazon in particular as a monopoly and face the kind of scrutiny that Microsoft was under.
You can't look at a company and say, because they're big, they're a antitrust violator. You've got to look at, how did they get to be big? How did they keep being big? What are they doing to prevent other people from competing with them? And those are fact specific. So even if my firm had not represented Amazon, I would be reluctant to sort of give you much of an answer to that.
That last part, saying that, of course, he had done business with Amazon as some legal business. But Tim, really what Boies was saying there was he actually felt that our current regulation is satisfactory to deal with companies like Amazon. And if we're talking about what we should do as a society, do you buy that? Or do you think we need like new kinds of laws around these companies?
I do not buy that. And I'm not even sure it's a matter of needing new kinds of laws, but interpretation of existing laws. At some point, following on, legal arguments by Robert Bork, the antitrust apparatus of the United States government decided that the only thing that mattered was consumer harm. You know, if you couldn't demonstrate explicit consumer harm, there couldn't be an anti-monopoly or an antitrust case, so just drop it and give up. Well, I happen to think that Americans and human beings in general are not just consumers. They're more than just that. And I think that the excessive concentration of power brings damage to things other than just simple consumer welfare, such as overly high concentration of political power and gaming regulations. And what we have been hearing about the anomalously high injury rates in warehouses and so on, all of those things are joined at the hip to the overwhelmingly large power, not just of Amazon, but of the tech sector in general, and not just the tech sector, but, the economy in general. So I disagree with Mr. Boies, and I think that there is immense scope for aggressive antitrust. And I'm super happy that they've appointed Lina Khan to run that division down in Washington, because do not underestimate that woman. She is incredibly sharp and very aggressive, and I think has a very realistic view of the deep structure of the economy at the high level and the need for drastic reduction in the collective power of big tech.
We could not talk to Lina Khan for this series, though we tried very hard. But we did talk to Congressman David Cicilline, who has introduced a whole package of antitrust legislation. So I just wanted to mention that we covered kind of extensively the efforts in the U.S. House to rein in big tech companies specifically, but also to modernize our antitrust laws. But we talked to Michael Cusimano when we had Tim Bray on about breaking up Amazon and possible legislation. Cusimano is the deputy dean at the MIT Sloan School of Management and author of The Business of Platforms. And he said this about antitrust enforcement and Amazon.
I would be very cautious about breaking up Amazon, but I do have certainly some thoughts about where they do seem to be potentially abusing their position. There's been a lot of complaints over the years about the Amazon store and Amazon Marketplace. So these are two separate businesses. You talked about them before, using data from the marketplace to inform which products or services Amazon should go into directly, or what we call self-preferencing, giving their own products a first listing after a search. Many people use Amazon to search. So those kinds of practices do seem to be abusing its position.
Well, Joshua, let me come back to you here. Again, you're living in the city where these decisions are emanating from about how Amazon wants to do business. Just your thoughts on the question of monopoly, and how does the growing sort of hum of the possibility, and I underscore the word possibility, given how Washington works, of regulation on Amazon, how does that go over in Seattle?
That's a good question. I mean, certainly among people who work at Amazon, there's enthusiasm for not breaking the company up. And among detractors, you have enthusiasm for it. I mean, it's a complicated question. And I mean, there are so many different parts of Amazon that it's when you've got it's a data driven company, and there are always people who are left out of the data. You know, I'm just thinking, going back to the grocery store, for example, you know, you've got decisions about what to stock, and the customers who shop at the grocery store request something when it's not there and they are listened to, but Amazon can decide whether or not people who aren't represented in that customer base should be reached out to. And I don't know, I'm kind of going off in a little bit different direction here, but I'm not sure really how to answer your question, I think.
That's okay. But I mean, the multiple directions that every question about Amazon goes is something that I learned about this company, because every part feeds into every other part. So I completely hear that.
I mean, we should say that about the start of the series in general. We yeah. thought that we could break Amazon up into 8 manageable pieces of hour-long conversations, and we got into each one of them and found that none of those parts were manageable,
no.
especially at AWS.
Well, 2 last comments, and then I have 1 last question for both of you. And we've gone over time, so I really thank everybody for your patience here. But we've got some comments coming in on the Slido where someone's saying the company needs to pay taxes. A la what you were saying earlier, Josh. Considerable regulatory oversight for mistreatment of non-corporate employees. Break it up. And this is the person identifies themselves as a very early Amazon employee. And then someone else says, I love what Tim Bray is saying. There are too many monopolies. We need more corporate breakups. So many people going out of business because of monopolies. So my last question for both of you is, again, I am very, very focused on what we as citizens need to understand about these companies, or Amazon in particular, in order to make good decisions, say, at the ballot box. So what is it, and Tim, I'll start with you. I mean, what's the one most important thing that you think we should understand about Amazon when we think about who we want to elect or what policies we want to support that people don't know enough about?
I think Amazon is an example of a company that does a very good job of playing by the rules most of the time, anyhow, and skating right up to the edge of the line and maybe over it here and there. But by and large, they are a company that plays by the rules. And that means that as a society, if we do not like what we observe Amazon to be doing, well, we need to change the rules. And yelling at Amazon isn't going to help do that. It's a job for old-fashioned politics. Find you know, candidates who share what is becoming an increasingly popular view of the unacceptability of the huge power and wealth imbalance, and are bringing practical ideas forward how to address that. Now, we don't need to change, we don't really need to invent new policies. There are existing well-known policies in the areas of antitrust and labor regulation and so on and so forth that, in fact, are being applied somewhat successfully in other parts of the world, notably Europe. So it doesn't require crazy radical ideas. It just requires a somewhat more progressive brand of politics with particular attention, as I think I've emphasized several times now, to antitrust. And, you know, when you've got a company that's doing something badly, you can regulate it and they will try and capture the regulation and escape the regulation. Or you can break it up into multiple companies and then let them compete against each other and have the free market work on your own side. I prefer the latter approach. But, you know, this is a reasonable debate we should be having as a society.
Yeah, well, point well taken. First of all, there's no such thing as a perfectly pure free market. And as in a democratic society, we have the right to make the rules of those markets. I think oftentimes of those markets, and oftentimes we forget that. We have that right as a society. And Josh, from your experience reporting on Amazon for so long, from seeing how, you know, what kind of a corporate neighbor it is in Seattle, would love to know what you think the rest of us away from Seattle should understand about the company that we may not already.
I feel like the city that Amazon is helping build in Seattle tells us a lot about the kind of country that we're building right now in terms of who benefits from this economy and who's left out. And I think we can take some lessons as to whether that's the kind of country we want to build by observing what's happening here with the distribution of wealth concentrated in a handful of tech companies. I don't know. There's some really great things that come out of Amazon and its technology and its innovation. Its people are problem solvers to the core, and many of them are very active on, you know, in civic groups trying to make the world a better place. This is a little bit, though, you know, the sort of Carnegie model where we look for the, you know, wealthiest members of our society to just sort of swoop in and help fund the underfunded homeless shelter, you know, as Amazon has done. It's built a homeless shelter in its headquarters, you know. But do we want our government to rely on that kind of largesse when it chooses to show its face, you know?
Wow. Well, you can see why, even though it practically killed Dory to do this series, I felt that 8 hours was not enough. But I just want to say to you, Joshua McNichols, thank you so much. Joshua is the reporter and host of the podcast Primed. It's all about Amazon. He's at KUOW, a terrific public radio station. We're so happy to talk with you, Joshua. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm sure all of our virtual participants are clapping for you too, Josh. And Tim Bray, now at Textuality Services, former vice president and distinguished engineer at AWS. Tim, such profound insight. Thank you so very much for being with us. And I really want to sincerely thank Dori Scheimer, our senior editor, who was the force behind this whole series and worked her fingers to the bone to break through that Amazon wall so we could do this series. Everyone at CitySpace tonight, it's been a fun real-time debugging exercise, and you did brilliantly, so thank you so very much. I also want to shamelessly plug, again, Josh's podcast, Primed, shamelessly plug our podcast, the On Point podcast, so subscribe to both if you haven't already, because here's why. Again, we need tools as citizens. We need insights. We need knowledge that we can rely on to make the kinds of decisions, to set the kinds of rules that Tim was talking about. And I will always, till my dying day, believe that public broadcasting is a place to get that kind of knowledge as citizens. So subscribe, okay, if you haven't already. And thank you to everyone for coming here to CitySpace at the WBR studios tonight. And thank you for everyone who watched online. Our success depends on your participation with us in this civic endeavor. And we always want to hear your ideas, always. So go to onpointradio.org. You can find always to contact us, send us your ideas. And for the full lineup of future CitySpace events, go to wbur.org/events. There'll be a lot more good stuff coming up as CitySpace fully charges into this new world of hybrid events. So thank you, everyone, so much tonight. It was really a pleasure. Thank you.